Captured Radio begins in 3, 2, 1.
So it's not a sin in your church to have an abortion?
That's the kind of conversation we would have, finding out your story, where you're from. God's the judge. People have to live to their own conviction.
The science is clear. The Bible is clear. And if we're honest, our intuitions are clear. We know what we're killing. We're killing a human being.
It's time for Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
What's the most important pro-life question no one seems to be asking right now? This is Wretched Radio. And no, I'm not Todd Friel. I'm Jimmy Hicks. And this is going to be a little bit different today. We are going to listen in on a conversation that Todd had with the president of the Life Training Institute and host of our Life is Best resource, Scott Klusendorf. Those two got together and recorded an episode of Breaking Bread. And we are going to take the opportunity to listen in on this conversation because I think it's a vital conversation, especially with how the world has been changing just this year.
Well, Mr. Klusendorf, can I call you Mr. Klusendorf?
It sounds so germane to the subject.
I've discovered something else we disagree on.
Oh my goodness. Add to the list.
OCD, a little bit of a germaphobe. You're clearly not. Do you know how many mouths have been on that cup?
Do you know how many tongues have been on the inside of that one? And how many times that straw has been recycled? Probably from California, where they recycle everything.
Did you ever follow the straw debacle? We've got some pickles. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Ruby, thank you. This is Southern food, man. These are deep fried pickles.
So how did a boy from Minnesota get into this?
Yeah, I really haven't. I'll be honest with you.
So you just ordered this for the...
Not quite there.
Okay.
Let me tell you about the Waffle House. Oh, what is it with the Waffle House in the South? I don't understand. Unless you like to go either get botulism or witness a murder, I don't understand.
Or learn how to fight, as I've been told lately.
Because the food ain't so hot. So, the straw debacle, did you follow why we're having to drink from paper straws instead of plastic straws?
Was it the 15-year-old non-scientist kid
who has become
the worldwide authority on what we can put in our mouths?
Right. And so because of his unscientific paper, 15, everybody scrapped the plastic. And now we've got the paper ones, and they're just not the same. Do you like drinking out of a... Clearly, you don't like drinking out of a paper straw.
I'll take my chances with the Bear Cup.
So here's something else we disagree on. And the reason I'm bringing these things up front is because it's my observation these days in Christendom, social media, just about everywhere, frankly, but mostly social media. If two Christians, born again, disagree about, pretty much anything...
You're under the bus.
You're under the bus.
You're at the Waffle House.
You are at the
theological Waffle House.
It's true. It doesn't. It seems to be not even theological subjects.
Right.
Social issues.
Yeah.
That, of course, there's a theological string attached, but these aren't like bullseye issues. Mm-hmm. And if you disagree, we just clobber each other. You and I disagree on stuff besides straws, but I think we get along.
Oh, we absolutely do.
I mean, we've done an awful lot of work together.
We have done at least, 30 hours of filming?
Probably.
At least?
Oh, at least that. Yeah, when we did Life is Best.
But I still haven't given you my phone number.
I know.
Because we disagree.
I know. It's just why I couldn't find
you. Do you agree with me, Todd?
You don't get the phone number.
Not going to happen.
I'm actually surprised you have one.
Oh, I know. I've had 5 in the last year. I lose them.
Because I don't know why. I sense you're a Luddite.
A little bit.
A little bit?
Yeah.
I'm an extra.
No, a lot.
A lot?
A lot.
Yeah. I actually think I might have some sort of like process, sort of like when you read backwards. What is that? That's Tom Cruise illness.
What's that called? Not dyslexia.
Dementia. Look at the
Well, I guess
of us.
I got that going on. Right.
When you read backwards, mm-hmm. What is that called?
Backward masking? I don't know. I have no idea.
So
I'd look it up, but I don't know how to use my phone.
But it's just a processing thing where your brain just, it runs it backwards. I'm telling you, somebody says, do you have the app? And my eyes spin.
Yeah.
And I have no idea what world they're talking about.
Yeah.
So on social media, people are at war we're not, even though we disagree on some stuff. You know the stuff I'm talking about, don't you?
Well, we disagree on the Dodgers and Braves. And I'm still trying to talk you out of speaking in tongues, but that's not going so well. And that's, you know.
It's actually a foreign language. Oh, these are hot. These are hot and good. You should
try
them.
Yeah. So what, help me out. What do we disagree on?
In a word, ecumenism. Right? Would you say that's a fair word that you...
Define it.
Well, the definition, the good definition of ecumenism is Christians working together to accomplish a greater good.
Yeah.
A form of ecumenism that where I think where you and I differ is as a pro-life guy, your willingness to work with religions that are outside of historic orthodoxy.
Right.
In order to accomplish a greater good. I disagree with that.
Okay.
Yeah. We're on a different page.
Right.
I've always known that about you.
And you invite me anyway.
You know what I think the reason for it is? And I think this is why we've got the social media hullabaloo going on. I know you. I think that makes a difference.
Yeah, it does. When you know people, you don't have to second guess their motives. You don't have to guess about their intent. And they can bring up a difference. And the intent there is not to harm.
I think that's why social media, it manifests itself so much because it's not the local church.
And it's also, not to pull you off your subject, which is our massive disagreements, whatever they might be. Rather, I think with social media, there's this immediate sense of, if I don't respond to you right now, I'm somehow weak. I have to prove my intellectual prowess by not answering you, but gunning you down with a snarky, quick response. And that does not lend itself to critical thinking.
And I'm all for snarky.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that on occasion.
Right. Seasoning an argument with snark can be okay.
But relationally, you know.
Right.
You've heard the classic joke about the man stranded on the desert island. Been there for 20 years. Finally, a rescue ship comes by. The captain rows on shore with some sailors. And says to the guy who's been stranded by himself for 2 decades, 3 huts. Why do you have 3 huts? He says, well, that's my house, that's my church, and that's my old church.
Right, right.
That the acrimony that is being manifested these days, in my opinion, we're all gonna be our own individual Christians.
Yeah. Yeah. We become our own popes. And we get upset that Catholics have their head of church, and we make ourselves the head of the church.
Speaking of which, you just came from a Roman Catholic high school.
I did.
Did you give them justification?
I did. I did. They got substitutionary atonement. Full throttle. And see, I love the tension of walking into a Catholic high school to give them not only the pro-life talk, knowing that there's a sizable number of students who disagree with me, but knowing I'm preaching the gospel to people who have never heard it.
Right.
And I can do that without sacrificing one bit what I hold to. Mm-hmm. I don't have to change. I don't make the gospel this kind of infused righteousness where God in justifying us makes us righteous. That is not the Protestant view of justification. The Protestant view of justification is God declaring us righteous, right, counting us as righteous.
Right.
It's an imputed righteousness.
All right, so it was 1,000 kids.
1,000 high school students.
Right.
And I gave them a case for the pro-life view. And this may be another place where I've sensed maybe we disagree,
really?
But I could be wrong.
Okay.
I include the gospel in virtually every pro-life talk I give, but I do it for a different reason than some people do.
Uh-huh.
Some people think if we don't preach the gospel, if people aren't converted in their souls, if they don't, if they're not reborn, they can't even grasp the moral logic of the pro-life view. I don't hold to that view. I don't preach the gospel to change culture. I preach the gospel because nothing else will save sinful human beings from their wretched choices that have brought them into a place of being enemies of God. And so we preach the gospel as the only solution to the pain the painful consequences of abortion.
Yes, defining what logic does and doesn't do, what it can and can't do, depending on your state.
Right.
I don't think that we can logic people into the kingdom.
Right. But we also can't preach them into it. We can't counsel them into it. We can't love them into it. If the Holy Spirit is not working.
Well, of course. We're talking about who does the regeneration, but the means is the preaching of the word. Right. But logic, people can grasp it in our fallen state to a degree.
Right.
And so by just reasoning with people scientifically, logically, they can kind of see the pro-life argument.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they aren't going to heaven because they suddenly become pro-life.
Of course not.
They need the gospel. And they would be more highly motivated, I think, to be pro-life because of their understanding now of Imago Dei.
Yes, you're absolutely correct. And here's where I think we do agree. You're not going to get anyone into heaven by converting them to pro-life, but you will save babies from the dumpster, and that matters.
Okay, I'm going to break in right here because that's what I do best, but hold on, this is just the beginning. Much more to come from Todd's conversation with Scott Klusendorf. Trust me, it's going to get even bigger. It's going to get even better. Coming up next on Wretched Radio.
Is it possible a Christian university can actually be ranked high when it comes to preparing students for the real world? Hat tip to Masters University. You want to send your kids someplace where they actually still teach the Bible? Not just based on a document that they maybe have in a file cabinet someplace, but they actually use the Bible there. The education at the Masters University, not only biblical, but oh so practical. Courses, diplomas, degrees, they can be achieved online or, of course, on their beautiful campus in Southern California. Would you like to learn more about the Masters University to prepare you or your child for the future? I encourage you to visit masters.edu/wretched, masters.edu/wretched.
Know your reformers. Martin Luther was a German monk and professor who was plagued with doubt about his salvation. When he finally read the Bible for himself, he rediscovered the doctrine of justification by grace through faith. His bold witness for biblical truth was the spark that ignited the Protestant Reformation. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
The pro-life argument is logical, but can logic change a heart? This is Wretched Radio, and today we're listening in as Todd and Scott Klusendorf have a pro-life conversation.
What I do think we may disagree on a bit, I think somebody can fully grasp the moral logic of the pro-life view, even though they can't ontologically ground their moral beliefs. An atheist is going to have a great deal of difficulty grounding objective morality because objective moral rules need an objective moral lawgiver, and the atheist or even today's practical secularist does not have that. So he borrows from our worldview, in essence, to try to get his own moral claims off the ground, but he can recognize them epistemically, even though he can't ground them. So I could speak to a non-believer, as I often do, and they will begin to follow the logic I'm laying out, and they can follow my syllogism. They can see the validity that the reasoning follows. They can see the soundness of the premises. They can recognize all of that. But you're absolutely correct. That's not going to convert anybody to Christ.
Yeah. And, you know, you call it the ontological connection.
Foundation.
That's what I'm for. They can't fully grasp it and get the big why.
No.
Without being regenerated. So all that to say, over the years, you and I have talked about some of this stuff, and we kind of like a little here, a little there, but we don't go to the mattresses on it.
No.
And it's funny because whenever I think about like you and our disagreements,
right,
I have to remember that the same restraint that I must have in order to like, you've got to have it with me.
Well, but Todd, we got to go back. We got to go back to our first meeting. People may not remember it. Do you remember our first single?
Was it at KKMS in Minneapolis?
It was at Minneapolis. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. The year was 2000.
Oh, wow.
Okay. A colleague of mine in the apologetics community had been on the air with you, and he called me up and said, dude, I understand you're going on with this guy. It was like the strangest thing I've ever done. I don't know what to tell you, but be warned. It is like nothing you have ever done before. This guy, I don't know if he's serious, just a nut, or trying to be a stand-up comedian, but I don't think you're going to find it very fun.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided I was going to
Going to do it.
So I walk in, and here's what you said to me on that first interview. You said, oh, you got your headphones on. You're sitting at your desk, and you got this chair next to you where I'm supposed to sit. It's all audio, right? And you say, we got this guy Klusendorf coming on. Klusendorf, what are you going to talk to us about? I almost got your impersonation down.
That wasn't even warm.
I know, but and I said, well, I'm here to talk about why your young earth creationism is bunk. Mm-hmm. And your eyes got this big, and you looked at me, and in that moment, I thought, he likes me. We're going to get along just fine, because we are both, sarcasm's our love language.
So here's the ironic right. thing to that story, though. I actually have Greg Kokel's phone number. Because I'm thinking that was the fellow you're referring to.
I'm not going
to
confess anything. I'm not confessing anything.
If it happened to have been a guy whose name sounds like Greg Kokel.
Maybe, maybe not.
I love Greg. Mm-hmm.
Phenomenal. He likes you too. But keep in mind, this was a staff meeting.
This was the first introduction to things. All right. So 20 years later.
Here we are.
More than that. Here we are. The pro-life issue has basically consumed your life.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Any issue, even a high-minded moral issue, mm-hmm. to be tenacious, dedicated, studying, traveling, which is about as much fun as a toothache these days.
Yeah.
What causes you to just keep banging?
Boy, that's a great question. Two things, I think, Todd. Number one, being brokenhearted over abortion. If you feel a 9-level pain over abortion, you'll put up with the 8-level pain of having to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And God got a hold of me in November of 1990 when I was an associate pastor at a church in Southern California. If you had asked me then, are you pro-life? I would have said yes. But I wasn't lifting a finger to stop the killing.
Right.
And I went to a pro-life presentation where a fellow by the name of Greg Cunningham, former member of the Pennsylvania House, showed a video depicting abortion. And Todd, I sat and I just wept. I just wept.
Yeah.
And I thought, I am no different than the priest and the Levite who passed by on the other side of the road. And that still is deeply in me. And I get up in the morning and there's this implicit question on my mind. What can I do today to help stop abortion? So there's that. The second reason is I really see my work is not a distraction from the gospel, but integrated to my gospel responsibilities. Both in terms of upholding the Imago Dei, but also the discipleship commands of the Great Commission, where Jesus says that we're to go make disciples. Well, what does that mean? Teach them to obey what he has commanded. One of those commands is we're not to shed innocent blood. That's what abortion is. Therefore, I see abortion as relating to my Great Commission responsibilities, not a distraction from being one who disciples, but actually being right in the crux of it. So those are the two things I think that keep me going. Now, getting back to this, if I may command the conversation for a moment, getting back to this Catholic high school I just spoke at, 1,000 high school students, almost none of them having a robust biblical worldview. And I can go in there, make a case for the pro-life view. They can recognize the reasonableness of it. Now, not every student. I had students who came up afterward that didn't agree with me at all. But we are able to give the truth of the pro-life position. Many of them can recognize it. And you asked, what did I do in terms of gospel presentation? So I'll go ahead and tell you what I did, if you'd like. I, before showing that video depicting abortion, I said, the reason we're showing this video is not to bring condemnation on people who have had abortion, because according to the biblical worldview, every one of us in this room is under condemnation by default. This is who we are by nature. And the story of the gospel, and this is my exact wording, here it is. The story of the gospel is God creates a good world, but we rebel against him and decide we're going to run the show. And God, who would have been perfectly just to save no one and toss the entire lot of us into the abyss, sends Jesus, the sinless substitute, to die in our place and bear the wrath and judgment of God that every one of us in this room deserves, so that those who trust in him for salvation are counted as righteous. Mm-hmm. I don't say made righteous. I say counted as righteous. And then I say, and God proved that this sacrifice was sufficient by raising Jesus from the dead. And those that trust in Jesus for their salvation, God the Father is no longer their judge. He is their Father, and they are adopted into his family as dearly loved children. Now, a criticism could be that that is a pretty basic, limited, not fully expressed the way an R.C. Sproul or a John MacArthur could, you know, exegete that whole thing. But I'm out to put a pebble in Catholic students' shoes to give them something to think about. And I'm doing it within the course of a pro-life presentation where the school is bringing me in to do that.
Well, but see, going in to speak pro-life,
yeah,
and importing the gospel, mm-hmm, that's radically different than, for instance, being invited to speak at the Mormon Tabernacle.
Correct.
And barely doing a drive-by with the right gospel and talking about all of the things that we have in common. That's right. Not what you go there to rescue babies.
I do.
All right. And with that, you're a Christian. You bring the gospel with you.
And I tell them up front, I'm not Catholic.
Right.
They know it. The school knows it, and I tell the students that.
Okay. So 20-some years ago, I was invited to speak at a Catholic youth group, and I accepted it.
Good.
And then about a month before, I started thinking about it, and I actually called up the priest and I said, you do realize I'm a Protestant, right? Yep. We like your message. We like what you have to say. We want you to come in and talk to the kids. So I went and I got up, and it was just a full-throated law, mm-hmm, gospel, resurrection, repentance, faith.
Yeah.
Explain. I mean, the total grace alone, faith alone, use the word alone. Not alone, just constantly.
Right.
It's all done. So it wraps up. The priest comes up and says, let us pray. And I went, oh, here we go. It's the old unwind prayer, mm-hmm, where they basically pray against everything
you just said. Yeah. We're going to dial it all back.
So he said, Father, we think now of the Apostle Peter. And I went, well, see, here we go.
Here we go.
Going to be some Peter Pope thing. And, who, when he took his eyes off of you, sank, help us to realize that our good deeds will not save us, and that we rely totally on the... And it's like he was talking like an evangelical.
Yeah.
So I don't know what was going on in that church. But I do know in that instance, because I was actually asked to come in and do that.
And we have much more Wretched Radio still to come as Todd and Scott Klusendorf continue their conversation next on Wretched Radio. And it's now time for your daily Fortis News Break, a production of Fortis Institute. The Trump administration has just cut off the money spigot to Minnesota amid revelations of massive fraud. Deputy HHS Secretary Jim O'Neill announced that they've activated their Defend the Spend system, which now requires justification and receipts before sending taxpayer dollars to Minnesota. This comes after independent journalist Nick Shirley's viral videos exposed daycare centers with no children, autism facilities buried in snow, and transportation companies that clearly haven't moved in months. Federal prosecutors say at least $9 billion in fraud occurred under Governor Tim Walz's watch. And Walz's response? Blame Trump for letting fraudsters out of prison. Because apparently it's Trump's fault that Minnesota couldn't figure out that empty buildings collecting checks might warrant investigation. And while we're on the Minnesota scandals, the University of Minnesota is 3 years into a nearly $600,000 study on anti-racist parenting, but only for white mothers. The project, called Carpe Diem, examines how white mothers communicate about race to children ages 5 to 8 with the goal of shaping racial awareness at an early age. And then over at UC Berkeley, a computer science lecturer has been suspended without pay for the spring semester after his 38-day hunger strike and subsequent classroom comments violated university policy against political indoctrination. And in better news for parents, the Supreme Court's decision not to hear Little versus Llano County stands as a major win. The Fifth Circuit ruled the Constitution doesn't guarantee a right to receive taxpayer-funded library books, meaning that libraries can indeed remove obscene materials without violating the First Amendment. A Swiss nonprofit has released an update to its Remember Me Bible Memorization app. The app uses spaced repetition for long-term retention, and it supports 44 languages, including biblical Greek and Hebrew, and it operates without ads or data collection. The app has been downloaded over 2 million times. Well, the world's number one female tennis player lost to the number 671st ranked male player in a Battle of the Sexes exhibition match, which just goes to show men competing against women is indeed biologically unfair. And Warner Brothers Discovery will likely reject Paramount's $108 billion hostile takeover bid, despite billionaire Larry Ellison personally guaranteeing the equity, with the board expected to pursue a rival deal worth much less money from Netflix. And that wraps up today's Fortis News Break. I'm Jimmy Hicks. If you want more, you can download Fortis Plus or sign up to become a Fortis Insider for exclusive daily content, both of which you can do at fortisinstitute.org. And don't forget, you can subscribe to Fortis News on your favorite podcast app in order to get these updates daily. And until tomorrow, go serve your king.
Important dates in Christian history. 529 AD, Benedict of Nursia establishes his monastic order outside of Rome. His written code of conduct, called the Benedictine Rule, becomes the most influential guide for centuries of monasticism in the West. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Should pro-lifers work with people of different faiths? Should we even stand on the same stage as them? This is Wretched Radio, and hey, I'm Jimmy Hicks. This is not your typical Wretched Radio. No, we're doing something a bit different today. Todd is actually sitting down with Scott Klusendorf, who's the president of the Life Training Institute and also host of our Life is Best resource, which you can find in the Fortis store right now at fortisinstitute.org. And now the conversation goes into unity and conviction and the gospel.
There is a little bit different scenario, and this may be getting more to the heart of what you sense might be a difference between us. Pretend it's a pro-life rally, like one I went to recently, that was run by the Knights of Columbus. Mm-hmm. And there were clergy from numerous denominations there.
I wouldn't do that.
And they had a rabbi, they had a Catholic, they had, well, several Catholics. They had a mainline pastor who surprisingly was pro-life, mm-hmm. because usually they're not. And then there was me. Mm-hmm. And in one of the remarks from the speaker ahead of me, he did make the case that, well, we basically all agree.
Oh, boy.
And we, you know, we all serve the same God, and mm-hmm. we are all after the, you know.
In our own way.
Yeah, that whole thing. So when I got up, I corrected that. And here's what I said. I did not leave the meeting because I didn't feel that was going to help. What I did is I stood up and I said, men and women, here's the beauty of the pro-life movement. We don't agree theologically. There is a world of difference between major doctrinal points between Catholics and Protestants and Jews. And I said, these beliefs are mutually exclusive. What we can do, though, is we can say that though we disagree theologically, we can act together for the common good of society to save children. That we can do. But we don't have to pretend we agree theologically.
Yeah, if the clarification is made,
it has to be.
That's a different thing, because the guy in front of you communicated, we're all the same. If nobody says that, I think that's what it does communicate.
Oh, it does.
Here we are, all on the same platform.
If I went up and said nothing, my silence is agreement to that audience.
Right.
I can't do that.
I'll noodle that a little bit, Scott. The scenario, the picture that you painted.
Yeah.
My second John 9 concern is this says kumbaya.
Right.
And I don't think we should be conveying that message.
No.
But if I could get up and say, for the record, we all disagree on one issue, Jesus Christ, who he is and what he's accomplished. I'll think about that.
Here's the thing.
And then I'll still disagree and blog about you.
Well, of course. And I'll put nasty stuff up on Twitter. I'm always looking at, is there good I can do where I don't have to compromise my core convictions? And is there a way to do that good without doing that? So, I mean, I'm going to guess, I could be wrong, 70% of my work is with Catholics. It just is.
Now, see, getting like fine combed on that.
Yeah.
You and I would agree with that statement. How we determine we're actually achieving that standard.
Yeah.
Let's just for the moment say you and I still disagree.
Right.
Okay. I can at least go, all right, I'll try to think about that.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
You said something. It's like, okay, if I could get up and do a disclaimer.
Right.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But I'm not persuaded at the moment. But you and I actually agree on it. And this is the beauty, I think, of Christendom and the Bible. It's Romans 14. It's 2 Corinthians 8 through 10. These gray areas, the disputable dispensations, where it kind of gets down to some of the application.
Right.
And we see it differently. Okay. I'm still going to try to persuade you to get off of that platform with that rabbi in the brace. Yep. But I don't have to go on the internet and hammer you.
I will still try to persuade you that if you get invited to be on that platform to share your pro-life views, that you would go and you would issue a disclaimer. And in issuing your disclaimer, you also have an opportunity to bring gospel in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you wonder about the Apostle Paul walking into a situation where he knows he's dealing with godless pagans.
Yeah.
I know there are commentators who make the statement that they think Paul blew it on Mars Hill. I don't think so. I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think Paul knew exactly what he was doing. But here's where I can take the warning from you. And that is, a guy in my position needs brothers who look over my shoulder and say, are you sure you're drawing those distinctives. Mm-hmm. The minute I say, I don't need somebody like you who maybe sees a little differently, that I can just float without input from people who, you know, I'm just cautious there. I think you get on very dangerous turf.
Yeah, I do too.
So the discussion here is a good reminder for me to say, okay, I'm going to keep going to Catholic schools. I do another one in 2 days, but I'm going to be reminded that that distinctive needs to be there. And I must never sacrifice that intentionally for the sake of an appearance of unity.
Speaking of unity, the pro-life movement itself can be fractured.
Uh-huh.
And I have to tell you, I see it as a bit of a bummer, to say the least. Mm-hmm. Specifically, the difference between abolition and incrementalism. Do you know of any pro-life, genuinely pro-life person who does not want abortion abolished?
No.
Okay, so we're on the same page, incrementalists and abolitionists.
Abolitionists and incrementalists agree in principle. We all want abortion abolished now, completely, all children protected. The debate starts when that can't immediately happen.
Mm-hmm.
And abolitionists and pro-lifers have two different starting points once that can't happen.
Mm-hmm. And the sad aspect of that to me is these are people. I know abolitionists. Mm-hmm. I'm an incrementalist like you,
right,
which doesn't mean we're like thrilled about incremental legislation.
No.
But nevertheless, if babies are getting saved,
right,
we're saving them from the slaughter.
Correct.
Then we're happy about the lives that were saved, but not content until it is obliterated.
No.
Okay. So these are brothers. Would you not agree?
Yes.
And yet, our ability to work together on the life issue has been crippled because of this disagreement. And look, it's a healthy disagreement. It's a substantial one. But wow, it pains me that we divided.
And I do have a couple of abolitionists that are friends of mine that we have fair-minded discussions where mm-hmm. we do not impute to one another the worst possible motives.
Sure.
And we are actually able, you wanted that word, so I was going to bring it in one way or the other. We're able to talk. And here's where abolitionists could really help the movement if they drop this notion that incrementalists have nothing but evil intent. And here's where they help us. There are some pro-life leaders who are just soft and they're not willing to press the envelope at all. They're not willing to take some bold moves. And abolitionists are not wrong to look at that and say, what's wrong with us? What's going on here? Where it gets sticky at that point, if we're looking at pro-lifers who are just cowardly and unwilling to push forward with aggressive bills that will protect children, hey, I'm with the abolitionists. I'm going to critique those pro-lifers. But when we don't have that ability, we do the greatest good we can given the political constraints forced upon us. Right. And we save as many lives as we can. That's not compromise. That's doing the best you can.
All right. Let me argue from an abolitionist standpoint. I think your representation of all abolitionists imputing ulterior bad motives to their incremental understanding are all evil. Do they all think that everybody's got horrible motives and they're really not pro-life at all?
The main people do. That's what their blogs say. That's what their websites say. That's what their videos say. Mm. A pro-lifer cannot write an article and not have 5 minutes later abolitionists crashing every social media site where the article appears and placing links to their own articles that allegedly refute what was written.
Okay, I'm thinking, though, right now of the Southern Baptist Convention.
Yeah.
I think a lot of folks there would say, I'm an abolitionist, mm-hmm. but they wouldn't look at a Scott Klusendorf and go, you are a bad right. actor, and you have ulterior motives, mm-hmm. and you're weak and soft. They wouldn't do right. that because, like most movements, mm-hmm. you've got the leaders, mm-hmm. and then the followers
right.
aren't always in lockstep. I would still like to argue, although this is your field more than mine, that the majority of folks will go, yeah, one abolition, they aren't thinking nefarious thoughts about incrementalists.
No, they're not.
Would you say the abolitionists are persisting in sin?
I would say they're mistaken, and I would say they are theologically wrong, and I think they are failing to save babies that could be saved now,
but they
hoping
aren't
for a future.
Living in willful rebellion, trying to maintain a lifestyle of sin.
I'm not accusing them of that. Good. I think they're okay. mistaken. I'm withholding judgment on that. I can have fellowship with fair-minded abolitionists.
Right.
I don't have to throw them under the bus theologically.
All right, got to interrupt just a second. We are going to continue this conversation with Todd and Scott Klusendorf in just a moment. Not everybody agrees with where to draw the line, and they are going to unpack the tension between strategy and theology coming up next on Wretched Radio. Look, I'm going to be straight with you. Every man knows what it's like to fight a battle no one else can see. You wake up, you're determined that today is going to be different. This time, you're going to be stronger than the temptation. But then evening comes, and there you are again, right back where you started. You're making promises to yourself that you already know deep down that you're not going to keep tomorrow. Here's what no one wants to admit. You can't win this fight with willpower. Trust me, if determination alone could break the chains of lust and sin, you would already be free. You've probably figured that out by now. The filters, the accountability apps, the promises to your wife or to yourself, they're just band-aids on a wound that needs surgery. Real freedom, the kind that actually lasts, it only comes when Christ changes you from the inside out. Not just your habits, but your actual heart. That's what Todd Friel gets into very deeply with his resource, Play the Man. It's available right now as an ebook, an audiobook, and video series only at fortisplus.org. Thanks for listening to Wretched Radio today. At Fortis Institute, we've assembled an incredible team of biblical voices who are equipping believers every day. Dr. John Krotz, Dr. Adam Tyson, Dr. Greg Gifford, Libby Glosson, Pastor Brad Bigney, Dr. Andrew Walker, Jason Lyle, Tim Challies, and of course, our very own Todd Friel. And their work has been invaluable in equipping believers because that's our mission. And the beautiful part, when you join us and link arms with us as an ongoing monthly gospel partner, your faithful giving doesn't just sit there. It multiplies into campus evangelism and biblical counseling, marriage restoration, and gospel proclamation across the globe.
And speaking of equipping people, make sure you download Fortis Plus. It is completely free if you haven't downloaded it yet, and it is loaded with hundreds of hours of content, with new content added every single day. No cost, no catch, just solid biblical truth. Look, the fields are white for harvest, and your monthly partnership make it possible. Join us as an ongoing monthly gospel partner right now by visiting FortisInstitute.org. Wretched, amazing grace, amazing gospel. You know what's annoying? Everyone acts like you should just automatically know how to be a man. Like it's supposed to be obvious or something. And then when you're struggling with temptation or you don't know what you're supposed to be doing with your life, they just say, hey, try harder, pray more. Yeah, I'll do that. Okay, thanks for nothing. Well, Dr. Adam Tyson is actually doing something. He's going to tell you the truth. A brand new Fortis Forum that you can find at FortisPlus.org. 5 steps to becoming a man after God's own heart. Dr. Tyson's going to give you real answers from the Bible. Not cliches, not go figure it out for yourself, but actual steps that will tell you and teach you how to fight sin with scripture, how to live with purpose instead of just reacting to whatever happens. Here's the best part. He's going to start with the gospel, so you're not trying to earn God's approval. You're going to be living from His approval. It's on Fortis Plus on demand. You can watch whenever you want at Fortis Forum with Dr. Adam Tyson. And it's free because Fortis Plus is free. Hey, if you're tired of guessing what manhood looks like, just go watch it right now. FortisPlus.org. FortisPlus.org.
Books of the Bible. Nahum, whose name means the Lord comforts, brought a message of comfort to God's people and a prophecy against Nineveh. Nineveh was a powerful city, but they were no match for God. He punished them severely for their wickedness. When you see evil or are tempted towards evil, remember that there are only two possible outcomes: repentance or destruction. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Abolition or incrementalism? That seems to be the question of the day. This is Wretched Radio. Todd has been talking with Scott Klusendorf, and they're going to continue their conversation now as they tackle one of the biggest divides in the pro-life movement.
In fairness, using the word abolition or abolish more, it's not a bad thing.
No. Todd, you and I are both abolitionists in principle, but we are forced to be incrementalists in practice while we continue working to protect all children.
And speaking of forced, was William Wilberforce an abolitionist or an incrementalist?
He was both. He pursued both strategies at the same time. And this is one of my beefs with the abolitionist movement. It's binary. It's not an either or. It can be a both and. Wilberforce pushed for the abolition of the slave trade, which was an incremental step to abolishing slavery in total. He also introduced bills that put regulations on how slave ships were outfitted. Boy, this sounds a whole lot like how we pass laws regulating clinics.
Abortion clinics.
Yeah. And Wilberforce, although committed in principle to being an abolitionist who wanted slavery abolished immediately, still worked incrementally, and the slave trade bill was a classic example of this.
But that kind of, I think, gets us to the crux of the issue, and that is political realities.
Yeah.
What we are able to achieve and what we can achieve can be two different things.
Very.
And to accept that reality, work within that system to try to do the best good that we can is not to surrender your abolitionist attitude.
No.
Because of political realities. Expand on that a bit.
Well, one of the things you'll hear abolitionists say when incrementalists like us say, listen, the Supreme Court and the federal courts have really handcuffed us on what we can do. They'll say, well, you're surrendering moral authority to the Supreme Court, to a man-made institution, instead of declaring the overriding moral authority of God. And that's...
Okay. Let's not just run past that.
Yeah.
Because that argument has power.
Yes. And I'm about to address it.
Okay.
Yeah. And they're right. God is the overriding moral authority. We as Christian pro-lifers do have moral authority. But to get something done in a constitutional republic, you also need legal authority. You need both. We currently do not have legal authority to protect all children, so we protect as many as we can along the way. While God is clearly the ultimate moral authority, for whatever reason, in His sovereign purposes, we have not been given by Him ultimate legal authority to protect all human lives. And why God has done that, I don't know his reasons.
That's the way he set the place up.
It is what it is.
Governments are ministers.
So I will continue working for legal authority as part of a constitutional republic, and I'm not going to quit until all children are protected or I die.
All right. How much of the disagreement between abolitionists and incrementalists do you think resides in eschatology?
I have seen a lot of abolitionists. They are essentially theonomists in terms of that theonomy is their worldview. They view that the kingdom of God now and the authority of God now, it seems to be the foundation. I'm not going to say they're all that way. I think that would be too broad a brush, but that does seem to be their view, as opposed to maybe someone like a Douglas Moo and others who would argue that we have a discontinuity between the Mosaic law that Israel was obliged to live under and what believers today live under and what republics like ours would live under. So there is that dispute that's idling there. I'm not sure how many people in the general public are aware of that or even know the fine distinctives.
Well, if you are a theonomist,
right,
that argument
makes sense.
Make perfect sense.
Right.
If you do not believe eschatologically,
right,
that there are two kingdoms, that it's right, one kingdom, and we should be seeking to have God's kingdom reign on earth today. Mm-hmm. Well, then the argument that we're ceding moral authority would be right.
Well, I don't know that it has to be right. Does it necessarily follow from that?
The supposition, though,
right,
I believe is not correct. Therefore, right, the conclusion isn't. But
correct,
if you were going to accept the supposition, then conclusion, I think they're consistent in that regard.
They are. And the irony of the incremental versus abolitionist approach is that all of us are incrementalists. We're all abolitionists and we're all incrementalists.
Okay.
I consider myself a principled incrementalist. I am an abolitionist in principle, but I will work pragmatically to save as many children as I can along the way.
Well, you know what, though? I don't think I like the word pragmatically there.
Well, let me define. I think pragmatic gets a bad rap.
But pragmatism, depending on how you want to shade the subject, it justifies the means because of a good end. I don't think incrementalism is that, though.
No. Well, let me take an issue with pragmatism here. Pragmatic can mean I'm the governor of a state and I have the means to outlaw abortion. And I don't do it because I think, you know, men will be men. You know, they have certain urges. They're not going to be able to control their sex lives. And, you know, we got to live in the real world here. And if we outlaw abortion, you know, there's going to be pragmatic impact that goes with that. And therefore, I veto a pro-life bill that would have protected all children. But suppose I am in a state where support for legal abortion is overwhelming. And I don't have the votes to protect all children. So I do the greatest good I can, given the situation I'm forced to work with.
See, I wouldn't define that as pragmatism.
We could haggle over the definition. You're correct that there's a sense where pragmatism eclipses objective moral obligation, where we say, I'm just going to be pragmatic and I'm not going to think about what my...
Because I want this, I'm willing to do that.
Yeah, that's shot through with compromise. But can pragmatic also mean prudent in the sense I do the greatest good I can, given
sure,
the hand that
I guess semantically it could. I think I think to avoid any of the ditches, I think prudent is exactly
I'm fine
correct.
With you substituting that word.
All right. So the Southern Baptist Convention came out with a statement. You weren't nuts about it. Mm-hmm. You wrote an article trying to persuade abolitionists to understand we're not trying to be evil here.
Right.
Was the argument not just in defense of, but for incrementalism? And I believe it was the story of a politician in India?
That was actually a different article, but we can work with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I made up a contrived story, a politician named Ahmad, who is...
Middle East.
Yeah, Middle East. And he's appalled at sex slavery in his country. And especially little girls that are traditionally sold into sex slavery at age 7. And for 10 years, they are living with an older man who, of course, is using them for sexual gratification. And then at age 18, They are sold back to the father, who then sells them to other men in marriage. And Ahmad is just horrified at this, but he doesn't have the votes to ban it. But the new parliament, he does have the votes to restrict this practice with all girls who were born nationally in that country. He can't do it for foreigners who live there, but that's going to save 97% of the girls in the country. And he's got the votes for that, and the prime minister is going to sign it. Well, on the eve of the vote, two of his fellow parliamentarians come to him and say, we can't support this. We cannot consent to the sex slavery of those that are unprotected by this bill. And unless this bill protects everybody, we cannot in good faith sign on to it. We must abolish this immediately.
100%.
So that next Saturday, there was a big auction coming up where all these girls were going to be sold. And 30,000 of them. If the bill is signed into law, that auction doesn't happen. If it is signed into law, every one of those girls has new homes on Sunday morning with new masters. The two parliamentarians do not see it Ahmad's way, and they vote against the bill. And that Saturday, all those young girls have new homes and new masters. Was that really the right thing to do? And that's the problem with looking at this in the way that a lot of abolitionists look at this. You're basically sacrificing children now who could be saved in hopes that you can roll the dice and save them later.
The response that I hear, though, and you kind of tagged this earlier that I think might actually be helpful, is that there are people, though, in the incrementalist movement, the pro-life movement, it's like, come on, where's any backbone whatsoever? And has this legislation really, they will actually, though, argue that this incremental legislation hasn't saved babies. What do you say?
Well, that's not the information I've seen. First of all, there's research by Dr. Michael New and others who have indicated that incremental bills have saved some lives. In fact, they estimate that the Hyde Amendment, which cut off federal tax dollars for abortion in 1976, has saved upwards of nearly 2 million lives. That's not a small number.
No.
And now, I'm not going to claim, as some would, that this legislation is just saving boatloads of lives. I don't think we can make that claim. But abortion rates have dropped. And one of the reasons why they're dropping is clinics are closing. These incremental bills do handcuff clinics. And keep in mind, the people running these clinics are profit driven. And when legislation comes in that cuts into their profit margin, they want to
their business.
They want to do something else.
And that is going to do it for today's episode of Wretched Radio. Thank you so much for listening. This conversation that you've been listening to with Todd and Scott Klusendorf is not nearly finished. And you can listen and even watch this conversation in its entirety at FortisPlus.org. And until tomorrow, go serve your king.